Okay, guys. What I thought we'd do for the next little bit is discuss an issue that I think for me has sort of developed over some time, and that is I have two questions: one about this past week's parsha, and one about a few weeks ago parsha. And maybe we'll be able to bring the two things together into one idea. Said, if we look in this week's parsha, the end of this week's parsha, and the parsha of Vayigash. I mean, I know we're on to Vayechi, but I think we can still look back a little bit. Right, the end of the parsha, the last aliyah is a little bit confusing. The question I'll ask is a question that actually the Abar Benel asks as well explicitly, which is why do we need this section of Chumash in the Torah? Okay, because it's the section where Yosef is interacting with the Egyptians and basically negotiating with them over how to get they want to get food, basically, from the Egyptians. It doesn't seem to directly link to what the Jewish people are going through. It's not really about the brothers anymore. So it's a little bit funny why we would deal with it. Now, the Abar Benel has at least four different answers to that question. I don't want to go through them. His explanation is pretty much, it allows us to understand the situation of the Jews in Goshen, basically. Okay, with one exception. One exception, he says, actually, I have something I heard also from Rav Meidan in a YouTube video, which is that the fact that the Egyptians end up paying one-fifth of their produce to the king makes the Jews feel better when we ultimately have to pay two ma'asrot as well in the future. We'll pay ma'asar rishon, and then depending on the year, either ma'asar sheni or ma'asar ani, right, this second tithe or for the poor. But we also pay sort of like two tithes. Two tithes is basically one-fifth. So that's a model for that. So that's sort of the Abar Benel's basic approach. Is like it helps the Jews understand their situation better in Egypt. I'll be honest with you, I don't love the approach. Okay, we can maybe debate it at some point. I want to show you something totally different and come back to that in the story, and hopefully we'll have a bigger picture, which I think also is relevant for the Jewish people. Don't get me wrong. I think that the Torah always, if you think about how the Torah functions, you have to always wonder, like, why would the Torah tell me this particular story? Right, and it should relate to something the Jewish people should know. That certainly is, it's valuable. Now, the thing I don't love about the Abar Benel's answer is that they feel a little bit short-sighted, I guess, in a certain sense. Like, is that really the point? But okay, we can discuss. But if you want to go back to the beginning of Parshat Miketz, okay, which is Perek Mem Aleph. So this is the story of Yosef interpreting the dreams of Paro. And the basic question I want to ask before we'll read through the story, we'll ask the question, what's so special about Yosef's interpretation of the dream? Okay, now we know by the end, he's like the greatest guy ever, and like he has to be the second in command. But remember, he's like a Hebrew slave in a dungeon. So it's a pretty remarkable thing. But something must be really great about his interpretation. So I want you to read it with a little more of a critical eye, thinking about if you were hearing this dream, what might you think? Okay, now it's a little bit of cheating because we know the result, we know the answer to the dream, but let's read it and we'll see. Okay, it says like this. Okay, it was 2 years later, Paro is dreaming, he's standing at the Nile River. Okay, again, I want you to think symbolically, right? Assuming dreams are meant to be interpreted symbolically, what would the meaning in the Egypt of the Nile River be? Okay, enough to answer the question. From the Yor, out of the Yor come seven healthy cows, and they are grazing. They're grazing. Seven other cows come up. These are bad-looking, sickly cows. And they stood next to the cows on the edge of the Nile. Vatochalna haparot ra'ot amarev dagot basar. The sickly, thin cows ate et sheva parot yifot amarev abriyot. Right? They ate the healthy cows. Vayikas paro. And paro wakes up. Okay? Vayisham vayicholom shenit. He falls back asleep. He has a second dream. Vinei sheva shibolim olot bekaneh chabriyot betavot. He says, now he sees seven stalks of grain. It doesn't say the Nile River anymore. Okay, seven stalks of grain. Very, very healthy. Seven very scorched, skimpy, bad looking stalks of grain. Again, the seven sickly stalks consume the seven full stalks. And he woke up and it was a dream. And now he was like all bothered and what's he supposed to do. Okay. So now, none of us are expert dream interpreters, I assume. Okay. But let's. I'll give you the following personal story. Okay, when I was maybe I've told the story before here, but when I was in make Aliyah, we decided to make Aliyah. So there's a period of time where I didn't have a job. I didn't know if I was going to have a job in Israel, and it was very stressful. Okay, that period of time, and I was very stressed like for a while, and I had a dream one night where I was walking along, and I felt something in my mouth, and I put my hand out, and my teeth fell out into my hand. Okay, all my teeth fell out into my hand, and I woke up. Okay, in the morning I was like a weird dream. So I told my wife, like, I had this really, really weird dream where like my teeth all fell out. She said, "Oh, that's classic." I said, "Class what?" She said, "Yeah, it's like one of those things, like, I don't know, she had read somewhere where like teeth represent stability because they're like, you know, you keep your teeth for your whole life, and having your teeth fall out in a dream represents a feeling of instability." Okay, so it's like an amateur way of interpreting the dream. Okay, but that worked very well in my case. Right, I was feeling a lot of stress, instability. I wasn't feeling very secure. And okay, I had a dream about it. Okay, so let's imagine the same thing, right? So Paro has his dream, okay? And without knowing, again, too much about specifics, what does the Nile River in Egypt represent?
It's similar to their stability. It's like where, like, the basis of their civilization.
The whole basis of civilization. You want to say a little more than that, a little more specific?
Keeps them alive.
The agriculture, the economic, like, the whole thing is based, right? Their whole economy is based on the Nile River. Okay, so something's happening in the Nile River, okay? So I might imagine maybe it has something to do with the economy in Egypt. Just might have to do with that. Okay. Then we have healthy cows and sickly cows. 7 of them. What does that represent? I don't know. Okay. I don't know what it represents. Something healthy and something unhealthy. And if something unhealthy consumes as something healthy. I don't know. I'm not sure how we get it on the first try. But remember, Paro goes to all of his people and he tries to get them to interpret the dream. And no one can interpret the dream well for Paro. Right? No one can give an interpretation. Now, it seems a little shaky to me. Like, to be honest, like, is this such a hard dream to interpret? Like, no one's going to come up with the idea that there might be some healthy years coming out of the Nile and some unhealthy years coming out of the Nile. Oh, by the way, there's 2 dreams. One is with cows. Maybe it's a little harder to figure out with cows. The second dream is wheat. Right? It's grain. It's like, wow, I can't be more explicit than that. That's what provides us the food. Right, that's the food. Like that's actually the source of. So you have one with the Nile, and you have grain. Again, he went to all his guys, like all his dream interpreters. No one can interpret the dream properly to say there's going to be 7 years. Again, what's 7? Again, days, weeks, months. Makes sense. I mean, again, right? It's not that the dream is an obvious interpretation, but it doesn't feel like no one would have come up with it. No one had an idea. So they get the slave from he's a Hebrew, he's an Ifri. We know that when Yosef actually takes over, right? And the brothers come down, the Egyptians won't eat with the Ephraim. Right? They're so like they're so offended by Ephraim that they won't eat with them. So but Paro takes an Ifri from the pit, right, from the dungeon, and he's willing to give this guy the what's going on here? That's right, it's a little weird. Seems a little weird to me. Yeah, you buy the question? Okay, so that's point number one that bothers me about that thing, okay? So some people say, well, the people in Paro's court, they didn't want to give him bad news. You know, so they all tried to get like a positive spin. Could be that. I don't know, I'm a little skeptical because it's a little hard to, again, like, I don't know, I'm a little skeptical just because it seems like such an obvious interpretation. Okay, but fine, let's say this. Some people say, well, you know what was special about Yosef's interpretation? It wasn't just the interpretation itself, it was his advice, right? What was his advice?
To save up. Prepare.
So again, I'm no genius or anything like that. But if I told you guys, you're going to have 7 years where you have a full employment, everything's going to be great. You know, you'll never have a salary like that your whole life. And then 7 years, you're going to have zero employment. You're going to be unemployed for 7 years. Well, I guess you're going to starve to death. You know, so what do you think you guys' plan is going to be? You'll be homeless. You got a plan? Can you come up with a plan?
The
salary. Yeah, I think saving is like, you know, things like, oh, I'll put some away every year, right? Just put some away, and then as long as I can put away, you know, basically half my salary every year, I'm good to go, right? I'm good to go. So the interpretation is like, you know, it's not so, it's pretty obvious, I would say, and the idea is sort of obvious too, and yet when it actually happens, Paro says, you know, right? There's no one who's as wise as you, Yosef, right? This idea you came up with, it's such a great idea. only you have to be the second in command, right? Couldn't be that Paro would be like, hey, Yosef, really appreciate your dream interpretation. That idea, pretty solid idea. I get what you're saying there. That's great. You know what? I'm going to commute your jail sentence. I'll pardon you. Maybe I'll pay you off a little bit because, you know, you did me a favor. And I'm going to hire my economic advisors to do the plan, you know, of saving the food for everybody. Because after all, you know, they're who I trusted my entire career. And you're like this nobody who I never heard of before. But no, only Yosef could be the guy. Now, again, this could be like a miracle. Like, you know, Hashem like sort of manipulating things. But let's not think miracle-wise. Let's think like logically. It has to actually like...
Can I put forward a suggestion?
Sure, yeah.
Well, I think like you mentioned like they hate like the Yivrim and like the rest of the... So like just in terms of like core politics, like they're constantly like... Like both like all his advisors and also like, you know, the Paro himself has to be wary of like someone trying to like take him out basically. And so an Ephraim would be someone who couldn't possibly threaten him because no one would possibly back him to replace Paro.
Oh, not bad. Okay, so like it's like if you're gonna have someone close to the government, have an outsider,
right?
Because the outsider at least like no one would back him up. That's interesting. I'd like that.
Challenge that.
Yeah.
Paro only heard of Yosef after he went to the rest of his advisors and wasn't satisfied. If he heard an idea that was satisfactory, it wouldn't have occurred to him. Maybe there's some
issue. No, but in terms of making him second in command, like if you have a smart guy who, at least I agree, like the whole thing is like, why is he so impressed with the idea? I think that's still a very valid question, but as far as like why he keeps him around to implement it, I think is a pretty shrewd move actually, because if your second in command can't possibly threaten you, then like that's a huge asset.
Yeah, it could be. It's still a little strange, but it's pretty good interpretation.
I think the main question that still stands, why is this such a like brilliant idea?
Yeah, what happened here? Okay, so let's try that. Let's jump ahead, and we'll look back now at our parsha. Okay, at the end of Vayigash. And we'll read a little bit together, and I'll do a little dramatic reading. We'll see, and maybe we'll come up with some type of idea. Okay, so it goes like this. If we were in Perek Mem, are we above? Mem Zion, sorry. Perek Mem Zion. And I think we're up to Pasuk Tet Vav. Okay? We're kind of done with like the story with his father and his siblings. Like they're taken care of at this point. Okay, Pasuk Tet Vav. Vayitom HaKesef Me'eretz Mitzrayim Me'eretz Canaan. The money basically in all of Mitzrayim and Canaan ran out. They come to Yosef and they say, like, give us bread. Why should we die? Because we are out of money. We're out of money. Okay? Now, what do you think they hope Yosef will say at this point?
Imagine, yeah, there's plenty. Take as much as you want right now. Don't worry about tomorrow. Just, like, indulge.
Okay, so indulge, don't worry, like just take as much as you want. Certainly that's a possibility. Yeah. Would that be short-sighted?
Yeah, but humanity is short-sighted.
Okay. Let's imagine they're not so short-sighted, but they ran out of money, so what do they want Yosef? I mean, I don't know.
They want Yosef to give him money. Like,
or, if they're giving him money, he could just give him food. Right. They might just say like, hey guys, you ran out of money? That's cool. I mean, after all, we're all Egyptians here, right? The goal here is that we should all be able to survive. So I'm going to just give you some food. I mean, also, like, remember, they've been stockpiling food for the past 7 years. I don't remember them getting paid. Maybe there was some type of deal. I wasn't aware there was a deal. They're getting paid, you know, a huge amount of money for that food. So it seems like it came from, like, their resources. But okay, I don't know exactly. But that's not what Yosef says. Vayomer Yosef havu miknechem. Yosef says to them, give me your livestock. I'll give you the food for your animals if there's no money. Okay. So they bring all their animals. So he gave them food basically for the horses and the sheep and the cattle and donkeys. So he provided them with food in exchange for all of their livestock and their animals that year. Okay, so far so good. Okay, so fun. So okay, they ran out of money, they could play for something else. Okay, now it says, "Batitom Hashanahi." Right, that year was done. By Avoe Lav Hashanahi Shinit, They came to him the second year. They said, you know, we're not going to hold back from you, right? But we're out of money, and you have all our money, and you have all our animals. The only thing we have left is our gviatenu v'admatenu. What does that mean? Gviatenu v'admatenu. Gvia is actually a really interesting choice of word. I mean, I'd have to do more research maybe on the word gvia, but usually gvia means a corpse. Okay, but certainly means a body here. Okay, but it means like all we have is ourselves and admatenu in our land. Lama namule necha, why should we die in front of you? Gama nachu gama admatenu, us and our fields. Kne otanu ved admatenu balachem, so acquire us and our land for bread. V'nieh anachnu v'admatenu avadim lefaro, and we and our land will become slaves to Paro. V'tein zera, and give us seed. V'nichyeh, and we'll live. V'lo namud, we won't die. V'adama lo tesham, and the land will not remain fallow. Okay, that's their offer. And Yosef takes it. Pasuk kaf. V'yiken Yosef et kol adnat Mitzrayim lefaro, ki machru Mitzrayim ish adeu, ki chazak aleim agra'ah, v'tehi ha'aretz lefaro. Yosef bought up all of the land of Egypt, because they all sold it to him. Because the famine was so harsh, and the land became belonged to Paro. Okay, now again, they come to Yosef. They have no money, they have no animals, right? And they say to him, "Look, Yosef, all we have is ourselves and our land." Now, I want you to remember that in an agrarian society, right, a person's land is that's all they got. Right, like there's a very close connection between a person and their field, their ancestral lands. Yeah. So when they say, like, you know, all we have is our bodies and our land, it's interesting. Like, if you think in the order of importance, you might flip it. We have our land and our bodies, but they actually say, no, our bodies and our land, which makes it sound almost like their own personal worth is actually less than the worth of the land itself. Right. Right. So, it's interesting, like you see, like it's, you get the sense that the land is really significant, and yet when they come to Yosef, like again, they came the last time, the previous year they came to him, they said, you know, we have nothing, we have no money, and he says, oh, so just give me your animals. They come back again, and I imagine like they're waiting for him to respond, and he doesn't respond. He doesn't say, like, he has no idea. He doesn't say anything to them. So I read it like when they say, the only thing we have left is our bodies and our land. So I'll give you an analogy from a movie, but it might sound like a rude analogy, but rude to Jose Pielzi. You'll see it in a second. Okay, so in you guys ever see The Godfather Part 2? Okay, so The Godfather, you ever see The Godfather? Plan? Okay,
yeah, but I know the general.
Okay, but you get the idea. It's a mob movie. Okay, The Godfather Part 2, part of the movie is a prequel. Like, what came earlier? How did the Godfather become the Godfather? Okay, like, how did Vito Corleone become the Don? So they're showing him, like, he comes alone to New York City in the early 1900s, whatever, and you see he's sort of, like, building up a reputation a little bit for himself. And you see he's a very clever guy. And he's getting this reputation and becoming a little more successful. Now, when you have a reputation, his reputation basically is that he will help people out. They need helping. Okay, that's sort of, like, what these mobsters do. But he's also running, like, these rackets of, like, you know, stealing stuff and whatever, like, you know, illegal business dealings. And a lot of what they're doing is sort of, like, you know, demanding loyalty. If you have loyalty, then you're good. And if you don't give me loyalty, then whatever. Okay, so there's the scene where this old, widow comes to actually the wife of Vito Corleone. And then the wife brings her to Vito. And she says, I have a problem, you know, like, my landlord is kicking me out of the apartment building because, you know, it's just me and, like, and I have this dog, and there's a no pet policy, but, you know, like, my son loves the dog, and we were, you know, just sort of like, you know, we need the dog for companionship, whatever. So, you know, we were hiding the dog, and the landlord found out, and he's kicking us out. Now I'm willing to get rid of the dog, but he won't listen to it anymore. You know, he's angry. He's kicking us out. So Vito Corleone finds a landlord and he says to him, look, you know, on the street, he says, look, you know, this widow came to me, you know, it's never a story, you know, it's really unfortunate. She has this dog. He's like, yeah, I know, I kicked her out, you know. He's like, well, why don't you reconsider, you know, be nice to her, you know, just be nice to her, and, you know, help me. I'd really appreciate it, you know, I'd really appreciate it. Guy says, it's ridiculous. You know, I already rented it out to somebody else. I raised the rent, you know, the whole thing, blah, blah, blah. And it's not worth my money. Peter Kalina's like, look, I just would, you know, a personal favor. Like, I just would appreciate, like, you know, man to man, you know, you do me this favor, I'll do you a favor, you know, in the future. You know, and the guy says, who do you think you are? You know, like, get out of my face. So the next scene, clearly he has realized that Dunmore has realized who he was dealing with. And he's dealing with this guy who, like, you don't want to mess around with this guy. Like, you know, you know, it's very nice to be all, you know, all friendly, but like if you cross him, it doesn't work out so well. So he comes and he's literally shaking. He can't like get the latch of the door open. He's like, and he's really upset. Oh, Don Vito, if I realized, you know, who I was talking to, you know, if I knew who you were, you know, I would have, you know, of course, I would have done something so different, and I wouldn't have told you, I would have spoken that way to you, and I wouldn't have, you know, kicked the lady out. Of course, I would have agreed to allow her to stay. At this point, Peter Corleone is sitting back very calmly. This guy's, like, very agitated, and he's very, very calm. The guy is very calm, sitting back in his chair, kind of smiling, and he doesn't say a word. And the guy's like, well, you know, I would have, you know, I would definitely let her stay in the apartment. And you know, I won't even charge the extra amount that I was going to be getting for the new, you know, I was going to raise the rent. I'm not going to raise the rent at all. It'll be the original rent. Everything's good. He just sits there. You know, right, you know, it makes sense. I think I'll raise, this is 1920s. I'll lower the rent, $2. $5, I'll lower the rent. At which point, Dino Corleone gets up, shakes his hand. So nice to interact with you. I'm sure we'll be able to do business again in the future. See you later. And the guy's like, okay, thank you so much. And he's like bowing as he's leaving. And he's like, he can't get the door open. He's so nervous. And he walks out. And okay, that's okay, right? And that's the scene you need, basically, to learn like how this guy, you know, negotiates, right? He doesn't have to negotiate with you. He just starts unless you negotiate against yourself, because you realize like you have no, there's no move. Right? This landlord has nothing to do. He knows like he's going to lose. Now, Lahabdil, okay, Lahabdil. The Egyptians come to Yosef and they say like, Yosef, I mean, we gave you all our money, we gave you all our animals. All we have is ourselves and our land. Okay, well, you know what we'll do? Why should we die, right? Why don't you just take us and our land, and you just, you know, that will be for the food, and we'll just be your slaves, and you'll have all our land, right? Because we want to live, he says, right? We'll live and not die. Like, we really don't want to die, you know? So we'll do that. And Yosef says, great. Vayom Yosef Alam, this is Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Hin Kaniti Etchem Hayom, Yeah, I've acquired you. Yeah, okay, I guess I acquired you for, you know, for Paro, etc., etc. Now, I will mention that this one, the Ramban here comments and says that actually Yosef isn't acquiring really the people as slaves, okay? That even though they offer to be taken as slaves, he makes them a different deal. And the deal is that they're going to be sharecroppers and they're going to get a pretty sweet deal, actually, because normally a sharecropper would only have to only earn 1/5 of the produce and they'd have to pay to the owner of the land 4/5 of the produce, and they're going to get the reverse. They're going to get to keep 4/5 and give a fifth to Paro. And the Rabban's saying that that's actually a real kindness that Yosef does to the people. Although, it doesn't sound to me so much the pshat. The pshat really does sound, to me at least, like that's what Yosef is doing. He's acquiring all the people and all the land, okay, for Paro. And that's what happens, okay? And that becomes like the chok. That's the way it works, that you just have this deal now. By the way, he transfers all the people from their lands into cities, so then they're completely disconnected from their ancestral homeland, right, or their ancestral lands. And they can function as sharecroppers, but they live in the cities now. They don't live in those places anymore. Okay. So what's going on here? So this is what I want to suggest, which is a little bit of a chiddush, but I think there's something to it, and then I'll move on to the next piece. And then try to answer our original question. I mean, the original question is, why is the story here? But the first question is, what's going on with the dream interpretation, Yosef in Paro? So what I imagine is as follows. Yosef sprout out of the pit. Paro tells him the dream. Okay, we discussed that maybe the dream isn't such a difficult dream to interpret. Yosef kind of thinks about this dream interpretation. Tov, I'm willing to suggest that power has heard an interpretation like this before. Okay, that's something about years of famine, years of plenty. I bet power has heard that before. But that dream is a bad dream. A dream of 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine, it's kind of a stinky dream. You know what I mean? It's like, well, you have some good stuff now, then things are going to get really, really bad for a long time. That is a bad dream. I don't want to hear a dream like that. Right? I don't want to hear an interpretation like that. But then he hears Yosef. Now, I'm going to imagine there's a subtext here. And the only reason I'm thinking the subtext and then is because of what happens after. Yosef says to Paro, you know, Paro, your dream is really important. And it means that there's going to be 7 years of plenty. Now, afterwards, there's going to be 7 years of famine. Yeah, and that seems pretty bad. But, if you save up all the food during the 7 years of plenty, wink, wink, you'll have enough food for the 7 years of famine. Paro, you hear what I'm saying? If you save up during the years of plenty, there's going to be plenty of food that you'll have control over during the years of famine. Understand what's going to happen there, Paro? There's an opportunity here for you. And Paro said, here's, you know what, it is a pretty good opportunity. Okay. No one else knows what's going on, necessarily. Yosef, you're the guy. And Avon v'chacham kamocha, there's no one like you. You have to be the guy to do it. Why? Because only Yosef understands what's going on. What does that mean? What's going on? What's going on is Yosef is hinting to Paro. Again, I'm assuming this is true, but I think it works nicely. Yosef is hinting to Paro, if you understand what to do properly during the 7 years of plenty, by the end of the 7 years of famine, not only will you guys be alive, you will control all of Egypt. You will own all of Egypt. You will have all the money. You have all the animals. You'll have all the land, and you're going to control all the people. That's what God is telling you in this dream, Paro. And Paro says, yes, that indeed does sound like an interpretation that comes from God. That does sound like a great prophecy from God who wants me to be great. And that's exactly what happens. By the end of say, for Bereshit, Paro owns everything in all of Egypt. Okay? Okay, so that's part number one, I think, is why is Paro excited about this human interpretation, even though it seems like a kind of an obvious interpretation. Oh, Nile River, economy, you know, fat cows, skinny cows, fat, you know, grains of wheat, you know, skinny grains of wheat, stalks of wheat. Probably not. Yeah, but what gets Paro excited is not the obvious part. It's the subtext that gets carried out by the end of the parsha. Okay. Why should Jews care about this? Why does the Torah want us to see that? Why is it important for the Torah to tell us that that's what happened to Egypt? Okay. So now, what I would say, suggest is as follows. That the reason is, if you look at the beginning of Sartre Dibro, okay, if you, I'm sorry, I don't appreciate it over there, but, you know, but I could take it by heart also. What's the first day of Sartre Dibro? Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hotziticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, Mi Beit Avadim. Right? I'm the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the Beit Avadim, the house of slavery, house of bondage. Okay? So usually when we see those psukim, when we say that Hashem took us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, what do we mean? What do we usually mean by that? So I think usually when we see that we mean that we used to be slaves in Egypt, right? And now we're free. And this is the God that took us out, right? And that's what you should think. But it calls Egypt a Beit Avadim, a house of slaves. Is all of Egypt a house of slaves? Or just the Jews are slaves? Well, the truth is, based on what we just learned in the end of Parsha Vayigash, is Egypt is a house of slaves. Everyone in Egypt is a slave. When God takes us out, you know, it's true, the Jews go free. But everyone in Egypt is still enslaved. Now we could quibble, you know, they're like sharecroppers, blah, blah, blah. Yes, maybe. But they don't own any land of their own anymore, which is sort of essential to being a free person. And they're completely at the mercy of Paro. Right? Maybe Yosef gave them a sweet deal. You know, where they get, you know, and they get 80% as opposed to, you know, and they only have to give up 20% of their crops. But the land doesn't belong to them. They have to move somewhere else. Right? It's a house of bondage. It's a place of bondage. It's a house of slavery. What Hashem, I think is saying in the beginning of the Esrat Dibrot is, you guys, this nation, the Jewish people, who are going to be moving to Eretz Canaan and living by the Torah, I took you out of that house of bondage. I took you out of Mitzrayim, because Mitzrayim is like the antithesis of everything that the Jewish people are supposed to be creating in the land of Israel. I'll give you a couple examples, okay? One example is, if you look in our Parsha, there's one group of people that doesn't have to give up their land. Do you remember? So if you look in, we're still in Parak Mem Zayin, right? So Pasuk Kaf Bet, 22. Okay, Mem Zayin Kaf Bet. He says, after it says, Beta'am ha'viro to la'arim, he moved the people to the cities, it says, Rak admat ha'kohanim lo kana. Only the land of the kohanim, the priests. Doesn't mean Jewish priest. It means Egyptian priest, right? He didn't buy. Ki chok la'kohanim me'i paro. Because the priest had a chok. A chok sometimes means the word law, but in this context, chok means a portion. Okay, we see the same idea in Chumash, actually. You see this, and in Tanakh, you see it, where the Kohanim have a chok. They get certain portions of every korban. Okay? You see the sons of Shmuel. The sons of Eli, excuse me. Chofni and Pinchas, right? They get, they're abusing the rights that they have to the food that they get from the korbanot. They're abusing the rights. It's the chok of Kohanim that they're abusing. The Kohanim get a portion, no matter what, of produce. Okay? The achluat chukam eshna talan paro. They were able to eat the portion they got. So Kohanim always got food in this deal. Al kein lo machruat avatam, therefore they never sold their land. There's never anything to eat. By the way, they also didn't sell their livestock. They didn't have to sell, they didn't have to buy, they didn't have to pay any money. They never had to give anything because the priests get what the priests get. How does it work in the Torah with Kohanim and their relationship to land? How much land did the Kohanim have in the Torah?
None.
Zero. The Kohanim are the one group that doesn't get land in the Torah. The Kohanim do get a chok, right? But they get a chok, meaning they get a portion of korbanot that we bring. They get truma. Levim get maaser, right? So they get, there's a certain amount of money that they do get from the Jewish people, but it's not in place of the Jewish people. You know, and their success, it's based on the success of the Jewish people. It's actually quite interesting if you think about it, right? In Egypt, the Kohanim are like a ruling class who are separate from the people, and while the people are suffering and they have to give up all their land, you know, and give up all their money and give up all their livestock, right? The Kohanim are sitting back enjoying the produce that they get for free from Paro, right? And they get to keep their land. Whereas in the Jewish system, the Kohanim, who are the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people, their material success is directly connected to the Jews' material success. If the Jewish people have a good year financially, right, crops grow, whatever, Kohanim will get more money. They get more food. If the Jewish people have a bad year, Kohanim suffer right along with them. Right? It's a completely different, the Torah is a completely different system for that which Egypt has. Egypt is, right, is creating a relationship where it's a very top-down relationship. The rulers are all powerful and have everything, and the people have nothing, and they're completely subordinate. And what the Torah is trying to create is an opposite model, where the people basically benefit from everything, and the leadership, Kohanim in this case, right? The leadership, you know, benefits from what they get, but nothing else. Meaning, it's in the best interest of the leaders in the Jewish system that the Jewish people are successful, right? It's economically beneficial, right? It's not just like, oh, it's a nice idea. Not like, oh, we like you, you know, we care about you, right? Even if the Kohanim aren't sincere, which let's assume they are, but even if they aren't being sincere, it's in their best interest to have the Jewish people be successful. You know that in Sefer Dvarim, it tells us about the limitations on the king, right? What's the king not allowed to have a lot of? So wives is one thing, okay? We can discuss that maybe a different time. What else can a king have a lot of?
Horses.
Horses. Why not so many horses? You remember why? The Torah says? Because it says, "Pen yashivita am Mitzrayma." It says they bring the people back to Egypt, because Egypt was the center of the horse trade. Okay? Now, bringing the people back to Egypt is a problem in reality. It's also metaphorically a problem. Right? Bringing the people back to Egypt is symbolic of something. You know what, the third thing that the king is not allowed to have too much of?
Money.
Right? We don't want a situation where the king is exorbitantly rich. Right? Because if he's too rich, then he sort of gets distracted from, like, you know, from more important things, like, let's say, like, God. You know? But also the people. Right? We want the king to sort of, you know, be a one of the people. Yes, he's the leader, but he has to be, you know, joining with the people that way. So what I would argue is, and I think we'll sort of, like, draw to a close if you guys have questions, but the idea we'll say here is that the lesson here is that the Torah is telling us this story about Yosef's acquisition on behalf of Paro, not for Yosef, on behalf of Paro, of all the land and all the people, all the money, yeah, is it creates a system in which Paro is the supreme leader and everyone else is enslaved. And the Torah uses this as a foil, as being the opposite of what we're supposed to accomplish. We're supposed to have a system under which every single person has dignity. Every person has land, by the way. Everyone in the Torah gets land, every Jewish person. Even if you lose your land over the course of 50 years because of financial difficulties, we have a system called the Yovel, where the land goes back to the, you know, right to the ancestral families. Right? So you can never have a system that over and over the wealth will be, you know, distributed unevenly. Again, short term, yes. But long term, no. Because everyone should have that ability to have sort of that land you can hold on to, that stability, right? And that's the warning. That, and then and having a king like that, it's not going to work. Kohanim, right? Our Kohanim don't need to get land at all. There's a lot of things in the Torah that speak to this. There's a lot more things we can sort of like point to, but we'll keep it short. And that's sort of the idea. So I think what we're seeing here is that with the interpretation of the dream that gets Yosef to this point, and we see what ends up happening to all of Mitzrayim, the lesson here is, it is for the Jewish people, but not the Jewish people necessarily, because like it benefits them in the short term. The benefit of the Jewish people is we have to understand what kind of place Mitzrayim was, and if we understand that, we'll understand by contrast what the type of community and society Hashem wants us to set up through the Torah, which ensures dignity for everybody, and not allowing the power structure to become so imbalanced in a very, very unhealthy way. And that I think is an explanation for this part of the Torah. I'll stop here.